The Celestine Prophecy, Cassette 3.
When I awoke, Will was already out of the tent. I could smell the aroma of hot cereal. I slipped out of my sleeping bag and looked out through the tent flap. Will was holding a pan over the fire. Renault was nowhere to be seen, and his tent was gone. "Where's Renault?" I asked, climbing out and walking over to the fire. "He's already packed up," Will said. "He's up there working on his truck, getting ready so he can leave as soon as his part comes in." Will handed me a bowl of oatmeal, and we sat on one of the logs to eat. "Did you two stay up late talking?" Will asked. "Not really," I said. I told him all I knew. Just then we heard sounds from the path. Renault was hurriedly walking down to us. "I am all prepared," he said. "I must say goodbye." After several minutes of conversation, Renault walked back up the steps and left. Will and I took turns bathing and shaving in the station owner's bathroom. Then we packed our gear, filled the vehicle with gas, and departed, heading north. "How far is Kula?" I asked. "We should be there before nightfall, if we're lucky," he said, then added, "So what did you learn from Renault?" I looked closely at him. He seemed to be looking for a specific answer. "I don't know," I said. "What conception did Renault leave with you?" "That we humans, although we are unconscious of it, have the tendency to control and dominate others. We want to win the energy that exists between people. It builds us up somehow, makes us feel better." Will was looking straight ahead at the road. He looked as if he was suddenly thinking of something else. "Why do you ask?" I inquired. "Is this the fourth insight?" He looked at me. "Not quite. You have seen the energy flow between people, but I'm not sure you know how it feels when it happens to you." "Then tell me how it feels," I said, growing exasperated. "You accuse me of not talking. Getting information out of you is like pulling teeth. I've been trying for days to find out more about your past experiences with the manuscript, and all you do is put me off." He laughed, then shot me a smile. "We had a deal, remember? I have a reason for being secretive. One of the insights concerns how to interpret the events of one's past life. It's a process of becoming clear about who you are, what you are here on this planet to do. I want to wait until we reach this insight before we discuss my background, okay?" I smiled at his adventurous tone. "Yeah, I guess." For the remainder of the morning, we rode in silence. The day was sunny and the sky blue. Occasionally, as we proceeded higher into the mountains, thick clouds would float across our path, covering the windshield with moisture. Around noon, we pulled over at an overlook that afforded a spectacular view of the mountains and valleys to the east. "Are you hungry?" Will asked. I nodded, and he pulled two carefully wrapped sandwiches from a bag on the back seat. After he handed me one of them, he asked, "What do you think about this view?" "It's beautiful." He smiled slightly and stared at me, giving me the impression that he was observing my energy field. "What are you doing?" I asked.
"Just looking," he said. "Mountain peaks are special places that can build energy in whomever sits on them. You look as though you have an affinity for mountain overlooks."
I told Will of my grandfather's valley and of the ridge overlooking the lake, and how it had made me feel alert and energized the same day Charlene had arrived.
"Perhaps growing up there," he said, "prepared you for something here now."
I was about to ask him more about the energy that mountains provide when he added,
"When a virgin forest is on a mountain, the energy is amplified even more."
"Is the virgin forest we're headed for on a mountain?" I asked.
"Look for yourself," he said. "You can see it."
He pointed toward the east. Miles away, I could see two ridges which ran parallel to each other for what looked like several miles. Then they converged, forming a V-shape. In the space between the two ridges lay what looked like a small town, and at the vortex, the point where the two ridges met, the mountain rose sharply and butted off into a rocky summit.
The summit appeared slightly higher than the ridge we were on, and the area around its base seemed much greener, as though covered with lush foliage. "That area of green?" I asked.
"Yes," Will said. "It's like Vicente, yet more powerful and special."
"How is it special?"
"It facilitates one of the other insights."
"How?"
I asked. He started the jeep and pulled back onto the road. "I'm betting," he said, "that you will find out."
Neither of us said much more for an hour or so. Then I drifted off to sleep. Some time later, Will was shaking my arm.
"Wake up," he said. "We're coming into Kula."
I sat up in the seat. Ahead of us, in a valley where two roads came together, was a small town. On both sides were the two ridges we had seen. The trees on the ridges seemed as large as those at Vicente and spectacularly green.
"I want to tell you something before we drive in there," he said. "In spite of the energy of this forest, this town is a lot less civilized than other areas of Peru. It's known as a place to get information about the manuscript, but the last time I was here, it was full of greedy types who didn't feel the energy and didn't understand the insights. They merely wanted the money or recognition they might get by discovering the ninth."
I looked at the village. It consisted of four or five streets and avenues. Larger frame buildings lined the two main roads that crossed in the center of town, but the other streets were little more than alleyways lined by small dwellings. Parked at the crossroads were perhaps a dozen off-the-road vehicles and trucks.
"Why are all these people here?" I asked.
He smiled daringly.
"Because it's one of the last places to get gas and supplies before going deeper into the mountains."
He started the jeep and drove slowly into town, then stopped in front of one of the larger buildings. I couldn't read the Spanish signs, but from the products in the window, I presumed it was a grocery and hardware.
"Wait here for a minute," he said. "I want to go in for a few things."
I nodded, and Will disappeared inside. As I looked around, a truck pulled up across the street and several people got out. One was a dark-haired woman in a fatigue jacket. To my amazement, I realized it was Marjorie. She and a young man in his early 20s crossed the street and walked right in front of me. I opened my door and got out.
"Marjorie!" I yelled.
She stopped and looked around, then saw me and smiled.
"Hello," she said.
As she began to walk toward me, the young man grabbed her arm.
"Robert told us not to talk with anyone," he said very softly, trying not to let me overhear.
"It's okay," she said. "I know this person. Go on in." He looked at me skeptically, then backed away and went into the store. I tried then, in a stuttering way, to explain what had happened between us at the gardens. She laughed and told me Sarah had related everything to her. She was about to say something else when Will walked out with a handful of supplies. I introduced them, and we all talked for a few minutes as Will placed the supplies in the back of the jeep.
"I have an idea," Will said. "Let's get something else to eat across the street."
I looked over at what appeared to be a small cafe.
"Sounds good to me," I said.
"I don't know," Marjorie said. "I need to leave soon, my ride."
"Where are you going?" I asked.
"Back to the west a couple of miles. I've come to visit a group studying the manuscript."
"We can take you back later, after dinner," Will commented.
"Well, I guess that will be okay." Will looked at me.
"I have one more thing to pick up. You two go ahead and order, and I'll order something when I get there. I'll only be a few minutes."
We agreed, and Marjorie and I waited as several trucks passed. Will walked down the street to the south. Suddenly, the young man with whom Marjorie had arrived walked out of the store and confronted us again.
"Where are you going?" he said, holding her arm.
"This is a friend of mine," she replied. "We're going to eat, and then he can run me back later."
"Look, you can't trust anyone up here. You know Robert wouldn't approve."
"It's okay," she said.
"I want you to come with me, now."
I took his arm and pulled it off Marjorie.
"You heard what she told you," I said. He stepped back and looked at me, suddenly appearing very timid. He turned and walked back into the store. "Let's go," I said. We walked across the street and into the small diner. The eating area consisted of one room and just eight tables and was permeated with a smell of grease and smoke. I spotted an unoccupied table on the left. As we walked over, several people glanced up at us for an instant, then returned to what they were doing. The waitress spoke only Spanish, but Marjorie knew the language well and ordered for us both. Afterward, Marjorie looked at me warmly. I grinned at her. "Who is that guy you were with?" "That's Kenny," she said. "I don't know what's wrong with him. Thanks for helping." She was looking directly into my eyes, and her comment made me feel wonderful. "How did you get connected with that group?" I asked. "Robert Jensen is an archaeologist. He's formed a group to study the manuscript and to search for the ninth insight. He came by Vicente a few weeks back, then again a couple of days ago. I..." "What?" I asked. "Well, I was in a relationship at Vicente that I wanted to get away from. Then I met Robert, and he was so charming, and what he was doing seemed so interesting. He convinced me that our research at the gardens would be enhanced by the ninth insight, and that he was on his way to find it. He said searching for this insight would be the most exciting thing he has ever done. And when he offered me a place on his team for a few months, I decided to accept." She paused again and looked down at the table. She appeared uncomfortable, so I changed the subject. "How many of the insights have you read?" "Only the one I saw at Vicente. Robert has some others, but he believes people have to rid themselves of their traditional beliefs before they can understand them. He says he would rather they learn the key concepts from him." I must have frowned because she added, "You don't like that much, do you?" "It sounds suspicious," I said. She looked at me intensely again. "I wondered about it, too. Maybe when you take me back, you can talk with him and tell me what you think." The waitress arrived and brought our food, and as she was walking away, I saw Will come in the door. He walked quickly to our table. "I've got to meet some people about a mile north of here," he said. "I'll be gone about 2 hours. Take the Jeep and take Marjorie back. I'm riding with someone else." He shot me a smile. "We can meet back here." The thought came to me to tell him about Robert Jensen, but I decided against it. "Okay," I said. He looked at Marjorie. "Nice to have met you. I wish I had time to stay and talk." She looked at him with her coy expression. "Maybe some other time." He nodded, handed me the keys, and walked away. Marjorie ate for a few minutes, then said, "He seems like a man with a purpose. How did you meet him?" I told her in detail of my experiences upon first arriving in Peru. As I talked, she listened intently, so intently, in fact, that I found myself telling the story with great ease and expressing the dramatic turns and episodes with insight and true flair. She seemed spellbound, hanging on every word. "Goodness," she said at one point, "do you think you're in danger?" "No, I don't think so," I said. "Not this far from Lima." She was still looking at me expectantly, so while we finished eating, I briefly summarized the events at Vicente up to the point where Sarah and I had arrived at the gardens. "That's where I met you," I said, "and you ran off." "Oh, it wasn't like that," she said. "I just didn't know you, and when I saw your feelings, I thought it was best to leave." "Well, I apologize," I said, chuckling, "for letting my energy get out of hand." She looked at her watch. "I guess I should be getting back. They'll be wondering about me." I left enough money for the bill, and we walked outside to Will's Jeep. The night was chilly, and we could see a trace of our breath. As we got in, she said, "Head back north on this road. I'll tell you when to turn." I nodded and made a quick U-turn in the street and headed that way. "Tell me more about this farm we're going to," I said. "I think Robert rents it. Apparently his group has been using it for a long time while he's studied the insights. Since I've been there, everyone has been assembling supplies and readying the vehicles, things like that. Some of his men seem very rough. Why did he invite you along? I asked. He said he wanted a person who could help interpret the last insight once we found it. At least, that's what he said back at Vicente. Here, he's only talked about supplies and helping to prepare for the trip. Where is he planning to go?
I don't know, she replied. He never answers me when I ask.
After about a mile and a half, she pointed out a turn to the left onto a narrow, rocky road. It meandered up a bridge and down into a flat valley. Ahead was a farmhouse made of rough planking. Behind it were several barns and outbuildings. Three llamas peered at us from a fenced pasture. As we slowed to a stop, several people walked around a vehicle and stared without smiling. I noticed a gas-powered electric generator humming at the side of the house. Then the door opened, and a tall, dark-haired man with strong, lean features walked toward us.
That's Robert, Marjorie said.
Good, I said, still feeling strong and confident. We got out as Jensen walked up to us. He looked at Marjorie. I was worried about you, he said. I understand you ran into a friend. I introduced myself, and he shook my hand firmly. I'm Robert Jensen, he said. Glad you two are all right. Come in. Inside, several people busied themselves with supplies. One carried a tent and camping gear toward the back. Through the dining room, I noticed two Peruvian women in the kitchen packing food. Jensen sat in one of the chairs in the living room and directed us to two others. Why did you say you were glad we were all right? I asked. He bent toward me and asked in a sincere tone, How long have you been in this area?
Only since this afternoon. Then you couldn't know how dangerous it is here. People are disappearing. Have you heard of the manuscript of the missing ninth insight?
Yes, I have, in fact.
Then you need to know what's going on, he interrupted. The search for the last insight is getting ugly. There are dangerous people involved in this.
Who?
I asked. People who don't care about the archaeological value of this discovery at all. People who just want the insight for their own purposes. A huge man with a beard and paunch interrupted the conversation and showed Jensen a list. They discussed something briefly in Spanish. Jensen looked at me again.
Are you here to find the missing insight, too? He asked. Do you have any idea what you're getting into?
I felt awkward and had difficulty expressing myself.
Well, I'm mainly interested in finding out more about the entire manuscript. I haven't seen that much of it yet.
He straightened in his chair, then said, Do you realize that the manuscript is a state artifact and that copies of it have been made illegal except by permit?
Yes, but some scientists disagree with that. They feel the government is suppressing new...
Don't you think the nation of Peru has the right to control its own archaeological treasures? Does the government know that you're in this country?
I didn't know what to say. The surge of anxiety in my stomach was back.
Look, don't get me wrong, he said, smiling. I'm on your side. If you have some sort of academic support from outside the country, then tell me, but I get the feeling you're just floating around.
Something like that, I said.
I noticed Marjorie's focus had shifted from me to Jensen.
What do you think he should do? She asked.
Jensen stood up and smiled.
I could, perhaps, work you into a position with us here. We need more people. Where we are going is relatively safe, I think. And you could find some avenues home along the way if things didn't work out.
He looked at me closely.
But you'll have to be willing to do exactly as I say, every step of the way.
I glanced over at Marjorie. She was still looking at Jensen. I felt confused. Perhaps I should consider Jensen's offer, I thought. If he was in good standing with the government, then this might be the only opportunity I had for a legitimate way back to the States. Perhaps I had been fooling myself. Perhaps Jensen was right, and I was in way over my head.
I think you should consider what Robert is saying, Marjorie commented. It's too frightening out there alone.
Though I knew she might be correct, I still had faith in Will, in what we were doing. I wanted to express this thought, but when I tried to speak, I found I couldn't formulate the words. I could no longer think clearly.
Suddenly, the large man walked into the room again and looked out the window. Jensen was quickly up and looking. Then he turned to Marjorie and in a casual tone said, "Someone is coming. Go ask Kenny to come up here, please." She nodded and left. Through the window, I could see truck lights approaching. The vehicle parked just outside the fence, 50 feet away. Jensen opened the door, and as he did, I heard my name mentioned outside. "Who's that?" I asked. Jensen looked at me sharply. "Be very quiet," he said. He and the large man walked outside and pulled the door closed. Through the window, I could see a lone figure silhouetted behind the truck's lights. My first impulse was to stay inside. Jensen's assessment of my situation had filled me with foreboding. But something about the person by the truck seemed familiar. I opened the door and walked outside. As soon as Jensen saw me, he quickly turned and walked my way. "What are you doing? Go back inside." Above the generator, I thought I heard my name again. "Go back inside now," Jensen said. "It could be a trap." He was standing directly in front of me, blocking my view of the vehicle. "Go back inside now." I felt totally confused and panicked, unable to make a decision. Then the figure behind the lights walked closer and I could see his form around Jensen's body. Distinctly I heard, "Come here, I need to talk with you." Then as the figure approached, my head cleared and I realized that it was Will. I rushed past Jensen. "What was wrong with you?" Will asked quickly. "We need to get out of here." "But what about Marjorie?" I asked. "We can't do anything about her right now," Will said. "We'd better leave." We started to walk away when Jensen called out, "You'd better stay here. You won't make it." I glanced back. Will stopped and looked at me, giving me a choice to stay or go. "Let's go," I said. We passed the truck in which Will had arrived, and I noticed two other men had been waiting in the front seat. When we got to Will's Jeep, he asked me for the keys, and we drove away. The truck with Will's friends followed. Will turned and looked at me. "Jensen told me you had decided to stay with his group. What was going on?"
"How do you know his name?" I stammered.
"I just heard all about this guy," Will replied. "He works for the Peruvian government. He's a real archaeologist, but he's committed to keeping the whole thing secret in return for exclusive rights to study the manuscript. Only he wasn't supposed to go looking for the missing insight. Apparently he's decided to violate that agreement. He is rumored to be leaving soon in pursuit of the ninth. When I learned he was the person Marjorie was with, I thought I'd better get down here. What did he say to you?"
"He told me I was in danger and that I should join up with him and that he'd help me leave the country if that's what I wanted."
Will shook his head. "He really had you hooked."
"What do you mean?"
"You should have seen your energy field. It was flowing almost totally into his."
"I don't understand."
"Think back to Sarah's argument with the scientist at Vicente. If you had witnessed one of them winning, convincing the other that he was correct, then you would have seen the loser's energy flowing into the winner's, leaving the loser feeling drained and weak and somewhat confused. The way the girl in the Peruvian family appeared, and the way," he smiled, "that you look now."
"You saw that happening to me?" I asked.
"Yes," he replied. "And it was extremely difficult for you to stop his control of you and to pull yourself away. I thought for a minute you weren't going to do it."
"Jesus," I said. "That guy must really be evil."
"Not really," he said. "He's probably only half aware of what he's doing. He thinks he's right to control the situation, and no doubt he learned a long time ago that he could control successfully by following a certain strategy.
He first pretends to be your friend. Then he finds something wrong with what you're doing. In your case, that you were in danger. In effect, he subtly undermines your confidence in your own path until you begin to identify with him. As soon as that happens, he has you. Will looked directly at me. This is only one of many strategies people use to con others out of their energy. You'll learn about the remaining ways later, in the sixth insight. I wasn't listening. My thoughts were on Marjorie. I didn't like leaving her there. Do you think we should try to get Marjorie? I asked. Not now, he said. I don't think she's in any danger. We can drive out tomorrow as we leave and try to talk to her. We were silent for a few minutes, then Will asked, Do you understand what I said about Jensen not realizing what he was doing? He's no different from most people. He just does what makes him feel the strongest. No, I don't think I understand. Will looked thoughtful. All this is still unconscious in most people. All we know is that we feel weak, and when we control others, we feel better. What we don't realize is that this sense of feeling better costs the other person. It is their energy that we have stolen. Most people go through their lives in a constant hunt for someone else's energy. He looked at me with a twinkle in his eye. Although occasionally it works differently. We meet someone who, at least for a little while, will voluntarily send us their energy. What are you getting at? Think back to when you and Marjorie were eating together at the restaurant in town and I walked in. Okay. I don't know what you two were talking about, but obviously her energy was pouring into you. When I walked in, I could see it clearly. Tell me, how did you feel during that time? I felt good, I said. In fact, the experiences and concepts I was relating seemed crystal clear to me. I could express myself easily, but what does that mean? He smiled. Occasionally, another person will voluntarily want us to define their situation for them, giving us their energy outright the way Marjorie did with you. It makes us feel empowered. But you'll see that this gift doesn't usually last. Most people, Marjorie included, aren't strong enough to keep giving energy. That's why most relationships eventually turn into power struggles. Humans link up energy and then fight over who's going to control it, and the loser always pays the price. He stopped abruptly and looked at me. Do you get the fourth insight? Think about what has happened to you. You observed that energy flows between people and wondered what it meant. And then we ran into Renault, who told you that psychologists were already searching for some reason humans sought to control each other. All that was demonstrated with the Peruvian family. You saw clearly that dominating another makes the dominator feel powerful and knowledgeable, but it sucks the vital energy out of those who are being dominated. It makes no difference if we tell ourselves that we are doing it for the person's own good, or that they are our children, and therefore we should be in control all the time. The damage still occurs. Next, you ran into Jensen and got a taste of what this actually feels like. You saw that when someone is dominating you psychically, they actually take your mind away. It was not as if you lost some intellectual debate with Jensen. You didn't have the energy or mental clarity to debate with. All your mental power was going to Jensen. Unfortunately, this kind of psychic violence happens all the time throughout human culture, often by otherwise well-meaning people. I just nodded. Will had summarized my experience exactly. Try to integrate the fourth insight fully, Will continued. See how it fits together with what you already know. The third insight showed you that the physical world is actually a vast system of energy. And now the fourth points out that for a long time we humans have been unconsciously competing for the only part of this energy we have been open to, the part that flows between people. This is what human conflict has always been about, at every level, from all the petty conflict in families and employment settings to wars between nations. It's the result of feeling insecure and weak and having to steal someone else's energy to feel okay. Wait a minute, I protested. Some wars had to be fought. They were right.
Of course, Will replied. But the only reason that any conflict can't be immediately settled is that one side is holding on to an irrational position for energy purposes.
Will appeared to remember something. Reaching into a satchel, he pulled out a bundle of papers clipped together.
I almost forgot, he said. I found a copy of the Fourth Insight.
He handed me the copy and said nothing else, looking straight ahead as he drove. I picked up the small flashlight Will kept on the floorboard, and for the next 20 minutes read the short document. Understanding the Fourth Insight, it said, is a matter of seeing the human world as a vast competition for energy and thus for power. Yet once humans understand their struggle, the insight continued, we would immediately begin to transcend this conflict. We would begin to break free from the competition over mere human energy, because we would finally be able to receive our energy from another source. I looked at Will.
What's the other source? I asked.
He smiled, but said nothing.
The Message of the Mystics.
The next morning I awoke as soon as I heard Will stirring. We had spent the night at a house belonging to one of his friends, and Will was sitting up in a cot across the room, dressing quickly. It was still dark outside.
Let's get packed, he whispered.
We gathered our clothes and made several trips out to the Jeep with some extra supplies Will had bought. The center of town was only a few hundred yards away, but few lights penetrated the darkness. Dawn was but a streak of lighter sky toward the east. Other than a few birds signaling the impending morning, there were no sounds. When we finished, I stayed with the Jeep while Will spoke briefly with his friend who stood sleepily on the porch while we completed our packing. Suddenly, we heard noise at the crossroads. We could see the lights of 3 trucks as they drove into the center of town and stopped.
That could be Jensen, Will said. Let's walk over there and see what they're doing, but carefully.
We made our way across several streets and into an alley that entered the main road about 100 feet from the trucks. 2 of the vehicles were being filled with fuel, and the other was parked in front of the store. 4 or 5 people stood nearby. I saw Marjorie walk out of the store and place something in the truck there, then walk casually toward us, gazing into the adjacent shops.
Walk over there and see if you can get her to come with us, Will whispered. I'll wait for you here.
I slipped around the corner, and as I walked toward her, I was horrified. Behind her, in front of the store, I noticed for the first time that several of Jensen's men carried automatic weapons. A few moments later, my fright intensified. In the street across from me, armed soldiers crouched low and slowly approached Jensen's group. At the exact time Marjorie saw me, Jensen's men saw the others and scattered. A burst of machine gun fire filled the air. Marjorie looked at me with terror in her eyes. I rushed forward and grabbed her. We ducked into the next alley. More shots were being fired amid angry shouting in Spanish. We tripped over a pile of empty cartons and fell, our faces almost touching.
Let's go, I said, jumping to my feet.
She struggled up, then pulled me down again, nodding ahead to the end of the alley. 2 men with weapons were hiding with their backs to us, looking down the next street. We froze. Finally, the men raced across the street to the wooded area beyond. I knew we had to get back to the house of Wilson's friend, to the Jeep. I was sure Will would go there. We crept carefully to the next street. Angry shouting and gunfire could be heard toward the right, but we could see no one. I looked left, nothing there either, no sign of Will. I figured he had run ahead of us. Let's run across to the woods, I said to Marjorie, who was now alert and looking determined. Then, I continued, we'll stay along the edge of the woods and bear left. The Jeep is parked in that direction.
Okay, she said.
We crossed the street quickly and made our way to within 100 feet or so of the house. The Jeep was still there, but we could see no movement anywhere. As we prepared to dash across the last street to the house, a military vehicle turned a corner to our left and proceeded slowly toward the dwelling. Simultaneously, Will ran across the yard, started the Jeep, and sped away in the opposite direction. The vehicle pursued.
Damn, I said.
What do we do now? Marjorie asked, panic returning to her face. More shots were being fired in the streets behind us, closer this time. Ahead, the forest thickened and inclined up the ridge which towered over the town and ran north and south. It was the same ridge that I had seen from the overlook earlier. Let's get to the top, I said. Hurry. We climbed several hundred yards up the ridge. At an overlook, we stopped and looked back toward the town. Military vehicles seemed to be pouring into the crossroads, and numerous soldiers were conducting what seemed to be a house-to-house search. Below us, at the base of the ridge, I could hear muffled voices. We rushed further up the mountain. All we could do now was run. We followed the ridge north all morning, stopping only to crouch down when a vehicle traveled along the ridge parallel to us on our left. Most of the traffic was the same steel-gray military jeep we had seen before, but occasionally a civilian vehicle would pass. Ironically, the road provided a lone landmark and point of security against the wilderness all around us. Ahead, the two ridges grew closer together and more steeply sloped. Jagged outcroppings of rock protected the valley floor between. Suddenly, from the north, we saw a jeep like Will's approach, then turn quickly onto a side road which looped down into the valley. That looks like Will, I said, straining to see. Let's get down there, Marjorie said. Wait a minute, what if it's a trap? What if they've captured him and are using the jeep to lure us out? Her face fell. You stay here, I said. I'll go down there and you watch me. If everything's okay, then I'll motion for you to follow. Reluctantly, she agreed, and I started down the steep mountain toward the spot where the jeep had parked. Through the foliage, I could vaguely see someone get out of the vehicle, but couldn't see who it was. Holding on to small bushes and trees, I worked my way between the outcroppings, occasionally sliding down in the thick humus. Finally, the vehicle was directly across from me on the opposite slope, perhaps 100 yards away. The driver, leaning against a rear fender, was still obscured. I moved to my right to get a better look. It was Will. I rushed further to my right and felt myself slide. At the last minute, I reached for a tree trunk and pulled myself back up. My stomach twisted with fright. Below me was a sheer drop-off of 30 feet or more. I had barely avoided killing myself. Still holding the tree, I stood up and tried to gain Will's attention. He was surveying the ridge above my head, and then his eyes dropped, and he looked right at me. He jerked up and walked toward me in the bushes. I pointed down the steep gorge. He surveyed the valley floor, then called to me. I don't see a way across, he said. You'll have to move down the valley and cross there. I nodded and was about to signal Marjorie when I heard a vehicle approaching in the distance. Will jumped into his jeep and sped back toward the main road. I hurried up the hill. I could see Marjorie through the foliage, walking toward me. Suddenly, from the area behind her came loud shouts in Spanish and the sounds of people running. Marjorie hid below a rock overhang. I changed directions, running as quietly as I could to the left. As I ran, I searched for a view of Marjorie through the trees. Just as I caught sight of her, she screamed loudly as two soldiers grabbed her arms and forced her to stand. I continued to run up the slope, keeping low, her look of panic frozen in my mind. Once at the top of the ridge, I headed north again, my heart pounding with terror and panic. After running more than a mile, I stopped and listened. I could hear no movement or talking behind me. Lying flat on my back, I tried to relax and think clearly, but the awful specter of Marjorie's capture was overwhelming. Why did I ask her to remain on the ridge alone? What should I do now? I sat up and took a deep breath and gazed over at the road on the other ridge. I'd seen no traffic while I was running. Again, I listened intently. Nothing except the usual forest sounds. Slowly, I began to calm down. After all, Marjorie had only been captured. She was guilty of nothing except running from gunfire. Probably, she would be detained only until her identity as a legitimate scientist could be established. Once more, I headed north, my back aching slightly. I felt dirty and tired, and pangs of hunger erupted in my stomach. For 2 hours I walked without thinking and without seeing anyone. Then, from the slope to my right, I heard sounds of running. I froze and listened again, but the sounds had stopped. Here the trees were larger, shielding the ground below from the sun, thinning the underbrush. I could see 50 or 60 yards. Nothing moved. I walked past a large boulder on my right and several trees, stepping as softly as possible. 3 other massive outcroppings lay along my path, and I moved past 2 of them. Still, no movement. I walked around the 3rd boulder. Twigs cracked behind me. I turned around slowly. There, next to the rock, was the bearded man I had seen at Jensen's farm, his eyes wild, panicked, his arms shaking as he pointed an automatic weapon at my stomach. He seemed to be struggling to remember me. "Wait a minute," I stammered. "I know Jensen." He looked at me more closely and lowered the weapon. Then, from the woods behind us, we heard the sounds of someone moving. The bearded man ran past me toward the north, holding the rifle in one hand. Instinctively, I followed. Both of us were running as fast as we could, dodging limbs and rocks and occasionally glancing back. After several hundred yards, he stumbled and I raced past him. I collapsed between 2 rocks to rest and to look back, trying to detect movement. I saw a lone soldier, 50 yards away, raise his rifle toward the huge man, who was struggling to his feet. Before I could utter a warning, the soldier fired. The man's chest exploded as bullets tore through from the rear, splattering me with blood. An echo of rifle fire filled the air. For an instant, he stood motionless. His eyes glazed. Then his body arched forward and fell. I reacted blindly, running north again, away from the soldier, keeping the trees between me and the area from which the bullets had come. The ridge grew constantly more rugged and rocky and began to incline dramatically upwards. My entire body shook with exhaustion and terror as I struggled up the spaces between the outcroppings. At one point I slipped and dared a glance backward. The soldier was approaching the body. I slithered around a rock just as the soldier looked up, seemingly right at me. I stayed low to the ground and crawled past several other boulders. Then the slope of the ridge leveled off, blocking the soldier's view, so I jumped to my feet again, running as fast as I could between the rocks and trees. My mind was numb. Escape was all I could think of. Though I didn't dare look back, I was sure I heard the soldier running behind me.
This ends side 1 of cassette 3. Please turn the cassette over and start side 2 at the same point.